we usually start out by doing is going around the room and everybody telling the tape recorder their name and spelling their last name. Could we start? I'm
sure.
Bob Hinckley with the FCIC. My last name is spelled H-I-N-K-L-E-Y.
I'm Alexis Simendinger with FCIC's writing team.
Donna Norman with the FCIC.
Haley Elias with Kalorama Partners. That's E-L-I-A-S.
Mandy Laduca with Kalorama Partners, L-A-D-U-C-A.
Harvey Pitt with Kalorama Partners.
Mr. Pitt, would you briefly state for us your background, education history, and work history since university?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate work at the City University of New York, Brooklyn College. I got an A.B. Degree in 65. I went to St. John's University School of Law and got a J.D. degree in 1968. From school, I went to work directly at the Securities and Exchange Commission, where I worked for something over 10 years, from 1968 to 1978, the last 3 years of which I was the Commission's General Counsel. In September of 1978, I became a partner at Fried Frank, Harris Shriver, and Jacobson, and was there until 2001, when President Bush appointed me as the 26th chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. I left in 2003 and founded Kalorama Partners, where I have been ever since. I have some other degrees, but I don't think they're honorary and other things. I don't think they're important. And if you want a resume, I'm always happy to send you one.
Can you just briefly describe what Kalorama Partners does?
Yes. There really are two Kalorama firms. There's Kalorama Partners, which is a strategic consulting firm. And then there's Kalorama Legal Services, which is the law firm entity. When I left the SEC, I did not want to go back to the traditional practice of law or taking adversarial positions for clients against my former agency. So we created Kalorama, whose mission is to help companies that want to do better. And we give a variety of advice. My goal was I felt that law firms were unidimensional, and I thought that we needed businesses that we needed to help businesses with a much broader array of skill sets, including economics, accounting, public relations, congressional relations, and the like. And so that's the idea behind Kalorama. The reason there are two firms is because there are some clients who feel more comfortable if they know they're protected by attorney-client privilege. We frequently tell our clients that if they do the types of things we're suggesting, they won't want to claim privilege, but it helps for some of them to give them that assurance. So they're two separate firms, and they contract separately with clients.
In every case when we interview somebody at the FCIC, we ask them this question usually last, but in your case I think I'm going to ask it first because of your history and position and your knowledge of what it's all about, really, and that is, what do you think the cause of the financial crisis was? I'll give you an open-ended one to start.
Well, part of the difficulty you will have in this interview, unfortunately, is that I'm not capable of giving short responses, for which I apologize up front. And so you should feel free to cut me off or interrupt me at any point, since it's what you need, not what I want to say. I think there were a multiplicity of causes, and it would be both impossible and counterproductive to try to frame it as either one or two or just a small number of causes, because that would hurt our ability to come up with relevant solutions. But given that, I think there are a number of causes. First, I think our regulatory system was badly broken. And in my view, notwithstanding Dodd-Frank, I think it remains badly broken, and therefore I am very worried that we have not really done what we needed to do to enable regulators to do a better job with the inevitable next crisis. I tell you that at the outset so you know. I mean, I try to approach these issues in a non-biased way, but you should know what my frame of reference is. So I put a lot of responsibility, in part, on our regulatory system. I have always felt that, contrary to a lot of the public debate, the issue isn't whether we needed less regulation or more regulation. The issue always was, how could we achieve better regulation? And I don't think that we had achieved that, and I can tell you why. But so I start by placing a great deal of emphasis on problems in the regulatory regime. Just to be specific, in a sense, and again, I remind you to cut me off when you think you've got other things you want to talk about, but first of all, our system grew up largely after the Great Depression. It's not completely after the Great Depression, but largely. And the system was based fundamentally on regulation by what you were born as or what you were called. I can't really go back and say that in the 30s that didn't make sense. But clearly by the 70s it no longer made sense. And the particular event in the 70s that, in my view, transformed financial services and financial services regulation was the advent of the money market mutual fund. I think it was a brilliant invention, but what it effectively did was siphon the nation's savings accounts into money market fund accounts. The notion that you could invest money while you were saving it, but have it available for use, was a problem that nobody really dealt with. Nobody sat there and said, this is a great idea, but what are its potential ramifications? How might this affect them? And the reason I say that is because after that occurred, and there were all sorts of legal issues about those concerns, the banking regulators became increasingly flexible about allowing banks to start doing other forms of business. All of this culminated with the passage of Gramm-Leach-Bliley, where Congress eliminated the barriers to combining investment and commercial banking, removing the restrictions of the Glass-Steagall Act. I have no quarrel with removing those burdens, particularly in a sense in light of what we've seen. I think that was both helpful and be inevitable. But what I do quarrel with is if you're going to allow everyone to be in everyone else's business, you have to revise the regulatory structure. And because it was not politically feasible, there was no revision of the structure. So we modified all of the rules of the game and didn't do a thing to adjust the regulatory system that went with it. I have a preference for free markets, but I do not believe that free markets by themselves can accomplish all that the public needs. The role of government, in my view, is to set standards, to oversee the application of those standards, and to put it in the vernacular, to bash people who don't comply with the standards. I don't believe the role of government is to do it itself, and so on, but I do believe that there is an important disciplinary role. When I say disciplinary, I don't mean enforcement. I mean creating the disciplines by which people engage in financial services that government needs to do. So that was a major problem in my view. I think the second but related problem was that at a time when new products, new services were evolving rapidly, government was ill-suited to really comprehend what was going on, and indeed, worse than that, had no mandate to do so. There were a lot of folks who wanted to say, for example, that derivatives should not be regulated. There are reasons why not having a direct regulatory scheme over derivatives, at least at the outset, may have made sense. To me, that's not relevant. But what is relevant is there needed to be an obligation for somebody to be collecting data, so and analyzing the data and disseminating the data. So to me, the second biggest problem was transparency, both internal and external. And if I might, and I realize our time is limited, but if I might, I give you a little vignette. Stanley O'Neill was the CEO of Merrill Lynch. And I'm not picking either on Merrill or on O'Neill. I'm just using this as a classic example, and I can get you the specific dates. But I think it was in 2007. At one point, he announced on behalf of Merrill in a public statement that Merrill would have a write-down of $4 million. About a week later, he said, actually, the write-down is going to be $8 million. And about 3 weeks after that, he said, we now think that the write-down will be $11 million. Now, the one thing that that indicated to me was that they didn't have a clue. You can't go from 4 to 8 to 11 or whatever the numbers were and not realize that markets are moving vastly beyond your capacity to predict. These announcements were observed by senior Merrill management, Merrill's board of directors, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve, the Department of Treasury, Congress. Everyone saw this. It wasn't hidden. And yet nobody stepped up, and it's always easy in hindsight, but nobody stepped up and said, wait a minute. What does it mean if a well-respected firm can't articulate what its estimated losses are going to be?
Can I stop you right there
for
just a second?
Sure, please.
Do you think there might have been a Sarbanes-Oxley violation with regard to Section 404? You picked a particular company.
Yeah,
I don't want to.
It's hard to say, and there might, there might well have been. I think 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley has gotten a lot of unfair knocks. First of all, it didn't change the law because the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act provisions that were put into the Securities Exchange Act already required companies to have adequate internal controls. So what was disconcerting about 404 is that any well-run business should not have required the government to tell it, you better make sure that you know that the assets you think you have are still there and aren't being used improperly. I mean, this seems to me to be corporations 101. So, there could well have been a problem. It is also possible, because these markets were deteriorating rapidly, that people thought they had good internal control and then discovered that they didn't. But the question is completely on point. It's right. You have to ask yourself what was going on. And indeed, I have said publicly that if Sarbanes-Oxley had really done what it was supposed to have done, we shouldn't have experienced the financial crisis that we have experienced. It provided a mechanism for better governance, better auditing and accounting, better internal controls, and yet this Merrill Lynch scenario, and Merrill was by no means the only one, this went on at every firm, really indicates that people were clueless. And all I know is if I'm in a business and I can't really accurately assess what my prospective results are going to be for a quarter, I ought to get out of that business. I just have no business being in there. And that's not to say they were venal or greedy or this or that. They may have been. But it is simply to say when I see markets moving against me like that, I have to understand that there is no conceivable way that I'm going to be able to understand and adapt to a market that's moving much faster than I can keep up with. And that's why I gave you that vignette. So
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, please. I only want to talk about what you all are interested in, so and I prefer interruptions. Wendy's, I'm sure, tired of hearing this. My youngest is 19-year-old daughter, Sally, and I often tell people when I give presentations to employ the Sally Pitt methodology, because she's about 19. She's now in the second year of this four-year vacation we call college, and she never waits for me to finish a sentence before she interrupts with her questions. And beyond that, she doesn't feel any need to have her questions relate to anything I'm saying. And I think it's actually a good approach. She gets her.
I thought I was
answer.
A little bit on point.
Yeah. But in any event, yes, you were. You were very much on point. But so interrupt away, I prefer. So I think you had the regulatory system was outmoded. You had a lack of both internal and external transparency. And when I say the regulatory system was outmoded, what this last crisis proved, in my view, is if you could reduce to one word, and you can't, but if you could, the single characteristic you want from your regulatory system and government, it's nimbleness. You want the government to be able nimbly to identify a problem, figure out solutions, and implement them. And what we have wound up with, I mean, before Dodd-Frank was a non-nimble government, and after Dodd-Frank, it's less nimble, in my view. So, and I have no particular axe to grind. I thought we needed lots of this. You had regulatory problems, you had transparency. In addition, finally, and it's an element of nimbleness, there really was not a clear ability on government's part to deal in a rational way as issues were evolving. A good example of that, in a sense, was the subprime crisis, which precipitated a lot of these things. Had been, and this is public, so I'm not revealing any confidential information, but I had been retained by Paulson and Company because they had shorted the subprimes, and they had obviously made a very clever bet. And then, lo and behold, they got a phone call from a major brokerage firm, effectively soliciting their participation in a market manipulation. And the call came to them because the folks who made the call thought that Paulson and Company was long rather than short. They came to me because they were worried that a market manipulation might occur, and there was an effort just to not to seek any specific result, but to educate the government. And so I visited with all of the major government players, and the first question I got asked at every agency is, do we even have authority to deal with this?
What period is this?
I think it would have been, it's either 6 or 7, 2006 or 2007.
Who did you talk to?
Oh, I talked to the New York Fed, the CFTC, the FDIC, the SEC, Treasury, and I think I talked, and the Fed. I think I talked to all the players. The point here was, in part, that people didn't know what they could even do. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act had prohibited the SEC from regulating derivatives. And while there may not have been a need for the SEC to have regulated derivatives at the outset, why would anybody want to write in stone that a government agency trying to respond to things couldn't regulated. And so now we have, you know, this huge provision in Dodd-Frank that goes on for pages and pages and so on. So the first thing is government didn't know what it could or couldn't do. Government was subject to a number of affirmative restrictions. And there was this tension, if you will, I think, between those who said, we overregulate everything, so we shouldn't, and those who say, we don't regulate enough. And unfortunately, I think both of those positions were wrong. And that's why I thought, and this is still by way of response to your question about what caused all of this. So I think, you know, regulatory system, transparency, clear responsibility and authority on the part of government, and as I saw it, when the current administration came in, I thought it could, if it had approached this in a different manner, could have achieved something of lasting value that would have gotten bipartisan support, and should have gotten bipartisan support. Let me put it that way, whether it would or did, it's not. And that is the three things that we needed in government. The first was the ability to require anybody who could have a significant effect on the capital or financial markets to report on a current basis significant information. Without that input, government is never really going to know. The second was to assign clear-cut responsibility for the government, within the government, to analyze that data and disseminate it to the markets. And so I'll tell you, one of the things that continually upset me when I was at the SEC, actually before I got to the SEC, and it's an agency I think is terrific and performs a great function, but they've obviously had a lot of reversals and setbacks as well, but is the SEC collects all of this data and then doesn't do anything with it. The most extensive data relating to things within the SEC's jurisdiction relates to mutual funds, and that's published by the Investment Company Institute. It's not even published by the SEC. So I had wanted the SEC, and I was not able to get this done, to become much more of an economically oriented business. I have nothing against lawyers. I wouldn't want any of my two daughters to marry one, but that's a separate kind of thing. I am a lawyer. Lawyers tend to be unidimensional. You want people who understand the economics of markets, how do markets operate, and so on. The Fed does a better job of it, but as I've said in connection with the O'Neill situation, they weren't there either. So there should be a clear responsibility on government to get this data, analyze it immediately, and then disseminate it. Obviously, there'll be questions about proprietary data and so on, and you may have to put certain things out generically, but government is very capable of doing all that. So that's the second thing.
And then stop you there for a second.
Yeah.
In your O'Neill example, if a company, a firm, would in the future be
compelled, required, encouraged to put this information together, what kind of discipline would that have imposed inside the firm to know more about what's going on? In other words, you're doing an inventory. You have to provide the information. Do you think it would be automatic that the executives and the board would then examine it on a regular basis before it went forward?
Oh, yes. And you'd let me say, I don't know that it would be automatic. I think you'd have to make it automatic. Companies have to know how leveraged they are. They have to know how much liquidity they've got. I mean, you know, in hindsight, we can see a lot of these things, but it does trouble me that people, well, I don't know how you run a business unless, you know, I run a small business, admittedly, but I have to know what areas of income I have. I have to know how much liquidity. I have to know how much debt I've undertaken, and I have to make sure that I can meet my obligations or else I'll be out of business. Somehow, our entire system lost sight of that, and people were aggressively chasing profits, and I have nothing against chasing profits, but they lost sight of the fact that there are no free lunches, and you have to figure out exactly how you're earning your money and what risks you're creating when you increase the amount of business you do in a certain way.
That's much more complicated in a large financial institution, isn't it?
It's very.
And were you surprised at how few of the investment banks seem to have a handle on risk management?
Yes, I was staggered by it. And in part because we had superficial regulatory requirements. So these investment banks were supposed to have compliance officers. It's very important. I'm not denigrating that.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to have risk management. Listen, I went through 9/11. They were supposed to have redundancy, and I was shocked to discover, and I spent my whole life in securities law, that when I got in 2001, the New York Stock Exchange's idea of transparency was they had their trading floor in Manhattan and they had a separate setup in Brooklyn. Now, that is not redundancy and so on. So, you know, you see a lot of problems, but I really thought people had been smarter because you look at these investment banking firms and they have some of the shrewdest people. And so, yeah, I admit it. I was completely surprised by the fact that folks didn't have a better handle. And as my O'Neill anecdote indicates, that even if they didn't, that when they were getting clues, nobody suddenly said, well, okay, what's going on? You know, O'Neill wasn't fired because of his heavy reliance on derivatives. He was fired because he had privately negotiated a price for the sale of Merrill Lynch, which turned out to be twice the price that Merrill Lynch wound up getting from the very same buyer. So I don't, you know, in hindsight, maybe they fired him, maybe they should have, but it wasn't for the right reason. He had gotten a better deal. So I think you need that transparency, and then I think government has to be able to set what I call tripwires. See, a lot of the debate is over who do we regulate and how do we regulate, and so that's when you get this division that comes about, and the two camps are fighting with each other and so on. The important thing is this. If you go back to my concept of nimbleness and also creativity, government has to have the ability to say, when we detect a trend, and I wouldn't let that be voluntary, that's why a prior step requires them to detect trends and so on, But when we detect a trend, and we're not sure, I mean, we see credit rising, we see a new market, subprime market rising, and so on, then government should have the ability to set a tripwire, which, if tripped, authorizes government to stop, look, and listen, to say, we don't know whether this is a bad trend or a good trend, but we do know that there are real serious issues, and so we have to stop this trend dead in its tracks while we figure it out. And that's how you make government better able to respond. You make it more nimble, you make it more creative, and yet you don't need 2,300 pages to accomplish all of that, with all due respect to the multiple authors of Dodd-Frank. So in a very long way, those now I can point to the fact that credit became incredibly easy and then was precipitously pulled back. Some people have blamed, for example, the housing philosophy of Congress, that we want people to own their own homes. To me, those aren't the real causes of this problem. If people can own their own homes, I don't, you know, why isn't that a good American value? That's not what troubles me. What troubles me is extending loans for the sake of extending loans, and securitization, which has taken an incredibly bad rap as well, was a brilliant idea in my view. If banks have the ability to lay off some of their obligations in extending loans, that could be a very positive thing, but not if what it produces is more loans to worse candidates. So you can quarrel, if you will, with the standards. But that's not where I think the problem really arises, and I think the people who want to focus on that, unfortunately, are really fall into the... I have said in Washington, in particular, there are two classes of people when you have a crisis. Those who want to solve the problem and those who seek to take advantage of it. And I think we have far too many of the latter and not enough of the former. And so, as far as I'm concerned, the real issue is having standards and having skin in the game, for example, which is now part of Dodd-Frank, is fine. But to me, the fact that banks could have securitization relieve them of certain direct obligations could never have provided a satisfactory excuse for not maintaining high standards of loans, and so that they don't follow. And what I worry about now, because I think the financial crisis is still ongoing. I realize that it is very popular, particularly in political circles, for people to claim we've solved the crisis. And I understand that's what politicians should be doing. They want to restore confidence. But in my view, we're in the middle of this. We haven't made real meaningful fixes to the system, and people are suffering far worse than the statistics evidence, and the most direct evidence of that is in the employment sector, because I've been around Washington for over 40 years, and everybody knows that BLS statistics grossly understate unemployment. But even as to the numbers that are out there, they understate it, because if I'm making $10,000 a year and I lose my job, but within 2 weeks I get another job at $5,000, BLS will report that as no change in unemployment. But that's a huge change in unemployment. And so the statistics don't really capture the suffering that's going on. And it's unfortunate, because you can't solve a crisis of this nature, in my view, by analogy, I grew up in the 60s. People said, with respect to the Vietnam War, we should declare victory and go home. You can't do that with the economy, because it hits everyone at home. And thus, I think we're in for a lot more suffering, and we will suffer with a system that I truly don't believe addresses those causes of the crisis. And they could be addressed quickly and easily. They won't prevent another crisis, but they might just ameliorate it or shorten its duration.
I wonder if I could put a proposition to you.
Yeah.
Before securitization, you went to your bank manager and you asked for a loan, and the bank held the loan and sat on its books, and its profits were determined by the loan getting paid back. Banks were examined regularly, overseen. The riskiness of that loan was constantly evaluated and revalued, and that had the effect of improving underwriting standards. When securitization came along, home loans moved to the securities market, which, instead of being regulated, was largely unregulated.
Right.
And I wonder if you think that's not something that's been fixed, as far as I can tell.
No, I think you'd hear folks tell you that because Dodd-Frank now requires banks to keep some skin in the game, but you know, it's 5%, and the minute I heard that, I said, that's fine. You just convert your 100% model to a 105% model. Banks will keep 5%, but it's still 100% that they're getting rid of. The point isn't being able to move these loans. The point is ensuring that there's continuing responsibility for both making the loans, administering them, and ensuring that the wrong people don't get loans. And there's no excuse for that. I mean, so you blame whoever you want, but banks that could got away with doing this. Securities firms that should have been analyzing this far better didn't. People who had no business taking loans because they could, I don't know. I was raised, my parents, I'm old now, but my parents lived through the Depression. And I have to tell you, they never allowed themselves or us to get into debt like that. They just said it's a trap. So the people who took the loans should have known. And the fact that somebody offers you the possibility of a loan you know you're not entitled to doesn't mean you should accept it. So there's more than enough blame to go around. But we have not solved this problem, because the real issue is who should get the loans in the first instance. And then how do you assess those zones? The second problem, and I'm sure the three of you have read Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short. I think he's a great storyteller. The difference between him and others is he has a fixed point of view before he writes, and then he uses his research to support it. But notwithstanding that, the book is fascinating for a different reason. You had five people or so, at least, that he focuses on, who are looking at the detail of these subprime loans and saying, this makes no sense. Now, the difficulty and the one point that nobody really dealt with in Dodd-Frank or in writing and elsewhere is, how can you have a system where what gets produced is massive verbiage and charts and charts of numbers and virtually no comprehension. When I went into the went back to the commission in 2001, I was very concerned, even though I made my living in the securities field, so that disclosure had long ceased to be about informing people and all about trying to create defenses to liability. The SEC allowed that to happen. That was one of the things I wanted to fix and so on. It still really hasn't been fixed. I gave a speech when I was chairman. I found a 1936 annual report. I forget the name of the company now, but I can find it. The annual report was a total of 6 pages. I read this thing, and it was phenomenal. And the company was saying, just coming off its best year, we had a great year, but, you know, we think we're going to be subject to a lot more competition. We think that markets for our raw products are going to be much more difficult. And so we have no idea whether this will continue. In 6 pages, and the financials were only 2 pages facing each other, you got an incredible picture of this company. And somehow, between that statement and what goes out now, which are hundreds and hundreds of pages of legalese, in people who are investing, people who are putting money at risk, don't have any comprehension of what they're investing in. And to me, Michael Lewis's book was amazing for the fact that the five were sufficiently aberrant that they were people who would go behind, you know, the generic statements and start looking, and concluded that this didn't make any sense. What were they missing, and so on? That was not the way the disclosure system was intended to work, but that is the way it worked in the subprime area.
Do you think there's something that was particularly damaging from a systemic point of view in that we weren't talking about one company here having opaque disclosure, but we were talking about the largest securities markets in the world, really, in terms of securitized debt?
Yeah. The reason I mentioned my assignment for Paulson and Company was when I went in to the government each of the agencies. I had to, first, before I could do it, I had to learn. But I had to explain to them how the markets worked. I had to explain to them how you could manipulate the market, how it wasn't just whether you were long or short a contract, but insurance and indices on insurance and so on. And this was an eye-opener. It was an eye-opener to me because, truth be told, I didn't know anything about this until my client helped educate me. But there's something wrong when government sees a new market evolving all around it and doesn't comprehend it. There is something very, very wrong with that. And the one thing Dodd-Frank clearly doesn't do is it doesn't deal with the next big market. Who knows what that development is going to be? People are very clever. They're supposed to be clever. They come up with new ideas all the time. We want them to come up with new ideas. But government cannot function the way it did. And I, frankly, don't believe, even with the FSOC, that it's been made any better in terms of its ability to respond. So, and trust me, I'm a glasses half full kind of guy, but I'm very concerned that we have missed a critical opportunity and will pay a heavy price for this going forward. That's why your work is so important.
Can I ask you a question about your Paulson example? When your client basically sent you to shout for the cop on the beat and you couldn't find one.
I'm sorry,
when they sent you in effect to find a cop on the beat, right?
Yeah.
And you couldn't find one who said...
No, I couldn't find
just go up and say, then what happened with your client's request? What happened?
Well,
He just died?
What we did was because it wasn't clear to me that there was a cop on the beat, we went to everyone we thought conceivably could be a cop on the beat. I'm nothing if not flexible, so, you know. And we explained it, and we talked to it, and we followed up with it. Because they were able to give specific information about phone calls and things that were said and so on, there was follow-up by some government agencies, and the publicity... And publicity is a difficult word, the sort of spotlight that had gotten placed on this shut down some of the manipulative activity. So they succeeded, we succeeded for them and so on. The manipulation didn't occur, but nobody was prosecuted. And unlike cases I know I had when I was a lawyer at the SEC and then when I was chairman and I looked at these cases, I mean, we had the name of the person who made the phone call. We had the language the person used. I mean, this was a gift, and no cases were brought. And I don't necessarily question that because I don't know what their thought processes were, but if they had clear authority to act against anybody who tries to manipulate any kind of capital or financial market, which is all they needed, maybe they would have done something. I don't know, but they didn't.
Go ahead, Donna. Sorry.
Prefer Bob if he wants to follow that line, but then I was hoping to take you back to your time at the SEC.
Yeah.
Before we go there, can I follow that line just for a second? You're talking about a a regulatory function that is much more proactive
yes.
in that it's as opposed to the traditional react thing we see where something bad happens, so then we pass a law to change
right.
it. Do you think that government, and I'll say specifically the SEC, was equipped to deal with, did they understand securitization well enough and what was going on in it when they were trying to regulate it?
No, not really. When I got into the SEC, so it's not a total loss for the direction you want to go, I felt...
I'm sorry, are you talking about your last tour as chairman?
Yes. But when I got in as chairman, right, I had a top-to-bottom management review done. It was finished and came up with a variety of recommendations on how the SEC could be more efficient and effective and so on. Since I was leaving, I left it to my successor, Bill Donaldson, who said he just wanted to read it and then he would put it out, and he didn't. But one of the things that was recommended that I was a big advocate of was the SEC never had risk management capability. You didn't have anybody sitting in the SEC, and I don't think the SEC is unique. I mean, I know it better than other agencies. I think this is true. People weren't sitting there and worrying about what the next problem is. And I'll give you this is, and there are people who can support it. It's a little off your topic, but it's just sort of humorous. When I came in as chairman, I had a staff meeting every Monday morning. Enron had hit, and it was a terrible crisis and this and that. And I said at one of my staff meetings, the next crisis is going to be in the mutual fund industry. And everybody looked at me because the mutual fund industry liked to say they had not had a crisis in 75 years. And so I said, and here's why. Social Security is in trouble. There are proposals to basically privatize Social Security. Those who oppose that are going to argue first that most people are not capable of managing their own accounts, and second, even if they were, that the market is rigged. So somebody will find a problem and it's going to blow up. Now, I had no idea what it was. I didn't know that it was market timing. This is what led me to want risk management, because having spent so many years in this industry, I couldn't tell you that there was going to be what the precise mutual fund scandal was going to be, but I could tell you there would be one. The same thing with Madoff. I had said to the staff and others, and I actually put out a rule proposal on this before I left in February of 2003. I said that when I got there, the SEC's Office of Compliance, Inspections, and Examinations, OC, claimed that they looked at investment advisors on a five-year cycle. And my response, because I practiced for many years in, with representing everybody, was first, I didn't believe that they were on a five-year cycle. But second, even if they were on a five-year cycle, it was meaningless, because if you've just been expected and you know you're not going to get inspected again for 5 years, you can cover up a lot of frauds. So we did propose outsourcing, in a sense, that is setting up a regime of having every investment advisor registered with the SEC undergo an exam either every year or every other year by a completely independent, wholly expert entity that would be regulated by the SEC, if you will, as to independence, as to expertise, and as to what to do the exams. But then they would write their exams up in a report, give it to the entity, but also give it to the SEC. And then I thought the SEC's OC group could actually do something meaningful, but they can't go in and do inspections because a lot of the people who are doing it are right out of college. I have nothing against kids who are coming right out of college, but they're getting paid, I don't know, $40,000 a year, and they're up against these firms that are managing $20 billion. It's a joke. It's a mismatch. Now the SEC has another 10,000 hedge funds under Dodd-Frank, private equity firms, venture capital firms. There's no way that they'll be able to do that. They don't have the talent. They can't pay what's necessary. And the system that I had come up with is not foolproof, but it's the same one we use for financial audits with public companies, only this would be a compliance audit. And my notion was that would spare the investing public some of the disaster. So can I tell you I foresaw Bernie Madoff? Absolutely not. I had no idea. But I did know that the way the system operated would produce something like that. But there was no institutionalized mechanism in the agency to try and prevent that. And that, I think, is true throughout government. Government is great at prescribing requirements for those it regulates, but not so great at following the same requirements itself. And until we get to that point, government will always be reactive, but my goal was to make them much more proactive. You put your finger on it, and at least understand that just because there's nothing wrong now doesn't mean that there won't be something wrong next week, and you've got to go look for it. That's the problem. I'm sure that didn't cover your question.
You mentioned earlier that a bit about the tension between too much regulation and not enough regulation and stifling competition. During your tour as chairman of the SEC, the Financial Conglomerates Directive was passed in Europe, and all of the major U.S. Investment banks and banks that did investment banking needed to find an equivalent regulator. During your tenure there, was there much discussion about whether the SEC would be the how the SEC would handle that?
No, that really that really was only just developing. It came up, you had the so-called voluntary system when Bill Donaldson was chairman, and then when Bear Stearns blew up, in particular, Chris Cox disbanded the entire program.
So prior to the CSE program existing, there was there's a lot of discussion out there in the world that perhaps the major investment banks, lobby is the wrong word, but approached the SEC and encouraged the SEC to get into the prudential regulation business. I think that may have happened toward the end of your tenure.
It may have. My wife likes to say the second thing to go when a man reaches my age is his memory. So I've But I don't, you know, we knew about the direction Europe was moving in. I don't know that we had gotten importuned, at least when I was there, but there is the possibility of misconstruing some of the elements. Prudential regulation, in my view, is salutary. It's not sufficient, but it's salutary, and we proved that when we responded to 9/11. When the markets went down, I went up to New York immediately. I met with all the exchanges, the heads of all the brokerage firms, and so on. And I said, if you all behave yourself, we're not looking for enforcement cases. We're looking to get our markets back up and running. We won't play gotcha. Of course, if you do anything, you know, wrong, we're going to come get you, but so on. And I suggested that we, and we did, set up a hotline for the industry. What I discovered was that was the first time in 75 years, almost, that the SEC had ever set up a hotline for people who are regulated. The problem you have, and I think it's going to be much worse, is if people have a way of calling in and finding out, now how would you handle this? The goal should be to tell them how they should handle it, because that is a much more effective form of regulation than after-the-fact enforcement. But at the SEC, people have always worried, well, gee, if I tell them it's okay to do that, and then a problem arises, somebody will say, I gave away the store, and these people will defend themselves by saying that they only did what the SEC told them. And so the notion of prudential regulation, I think, is a good one, to the extent that it means tell people what the standards are. I know it's a cliche, but I'm fond of saying God was able to tell all of the people of the world what to do in 10 commandments. And you should juxtapose that with Dodd-Frank, which takes 2,300 pages to tell them some of the things they need to do. There has to be something wrong with a system that produces so much verbiage and doesn't focus on what the goals are, the principles are, and the consequences. So prudential regulation can be very effective. Second, although Chris Cox disbanded the system because it was voluntary, that wasn't what the problem was. The problem isn't with a voluntary system. When I was chairman, I was asked a question on the Hill about the quality of disclosure by Fannie and Freddie, and their claim that they did it better than would anybody who's subject to the securities laws, that they were as good or better. And so they asked me what I thought, and I said, well, if they really think they're as good or better, then they should be subject to this, which created a whole hullabaloo. But Fannie came in and registered, and the one condition I insisted on was, we'll let you register and do this, but we're not going to let you out. In other words, if you volunteer to come under this system, I want it ironclad that you don't have the right to withdraw from the system. So the CSC system could have worked, even if it was initially voluntary. The problem wasn't that it was voluntary. The problem was it wasn't really handled very effectively. And And it wasn't that it was prudential regulation, it was that the regulation was not very effective. That is what really created a huge piece of the problem. But those are solvable if you want it to be as good as a mandatory program. That's sort of the way I look at that.
Entering in, leaving the CSE program aside.
Yeah.
Even prior to the CSE program, trading markets and market regulation, I guess, when you were there, they did have some jurisdiction under 17H over the holding company, mm-hmm. at least as to whether it was impacting the broker-dealer.
Mm-hmm.
During that period of time, in 2001 and 2003, as the derivatives markets were expanding, any discussion about even if we don't have enforcement jurisdiction over derivatives, and even if we don't have prudential regulation of the holding company, are we really able to even determine whether the holding company will impact the broker dealer if we don't really understand the derivative models and the bars?
Did
that discussion occur?
I don't.
You can tell me about that.
Yeah, no. I don't. I'm not going to grade the question. But it's a great question. Again, I don't recall it that specific. But what I will tell you is, while I was chairman, NASDAQ wanted to merge with the London Stock Exchange, and so they came in with an agreement. And they were going to create a UK holding company. And so I met, and I said, I told the staff I wanted to meet not just with NASDAQ, but with their outside lawyers, Skadden Arps. And I said, look, here's my regulatory concern. If we create a UK holding company, and then the UK holding company wants to siphon up profits out of the broker-dealer, out of the exchange, the U.S. NASDAQ operation, what protection do I have? And ironically, Rick Ketchum, who was with NASDAQ at the time, said, oh, well, there's no problem. You can fire everybody who runs NASDAQ because you have that power. I said, that's meaningless. Okay, that's no real power because, first of all, I'd have to crank up a proceeding. It'll take me a year to do it. And in the meantime, money is going to be siphoned out of NASDAQ. How do I, as a U.S. regulator, satisfy myself? And I said, I used to do takeover work and so on. I said, there are very simple issues. I want ironclad in the acquisition agreement that, number one, they cannot upstream revenues without clearing it through the U.S. regulator, and that if there are issues about that, they all get litigated here, not in the U.K. and so on, because you can have choice of law and choice of provision. So while I didn't have the specific conversation you did, if I had had it, and part of this was based on my experience when I was practicing law, representing Lloyd's of London, because they had agreements that required people to litigate in the UK subject to UK law. And in the U.S., securities investors who were unhappy with Lloyd's tried to sue under the securities laws, and I argued all these cases in court. We won every one of them. Eventually, the courts agreed that if you put a provision like that in an agreement, it's binding. So had we had the discussion, and I don't recall having it, but if we had had the discussion, I would have said there's a very simple mechanism. We can do this contractually, even if we can't do it directly by statute, or we don't allow it. And we control these folks. So I think there was authority within the SEC to do that, but I heard no discussions, and frankly, the only issue of derivatives that I actually recall, much to my regret, is that Alan Greenspan was very concerned about efforts to try and regulate derivatives and wanted to and did replicate the letter that Arthur Levitt and Greenspan and others signed back in 99 or whatever and so on. But other than that, we didn't have a lot of, that I recall, a lot of discussion about derivatives.
This is more just to get your perspective on and to hear if there were any early warning signs during your tour, because it kind of falls around you.
Mm-hmm.
Since 1975, the SEC has given statutory favored status to those who are AAA-rated. You know, so they've written into their statutes.
Yeah.
And the Division of Market Regulation relies upon those ratings to give their haircuts for the regulatory capital the broker-dealer has to hold. So if we can talk about the broker-dealers, which were... you know, which are the SEC's
yes.
blood source.
Mm-hmm.
They're that's the wrong word.
No. But they are their principal regulatee.
Absolutely. We talk about the broker dealers. During that period, from 2001 to 2003, and if you'd like to speak after that from your private sector experience, that would be terrific as well. But what should the, you know, what did the SEC see or do or anything you can speak to is discussions internally about whether that reliance was okay, given that the SEC had no jurisdiction over the rating agencies?
We did have, I do recall some discussions and... Your last comment is actually a starting point because, unfortunately, the SEC had no jurisdiction over ratings agencies. The second problem was that, and I've never understood this, the ratings agencies were able to get courts to say that when they issued their credit ratings, that was an opinion governed by the First Amendment. And I, in private practice, represented all of the major accounting firms and plus the AICPA and so on, all that, and I just said, how come you guys never got this? I mean, this would have solved your problems and so on and so forth. I said, you know, I think it's crazy, but, you know, courts were holding us. So I will tell you that... it was only because of the pendency of Sarbanes-Oxley that I even discovered, and I'm embarrassed to admit, but it just wasn't something I was cognizant of, that the SEC had really created a monopoly for these nationally registered securities rating agencies, created all sorts of exceptions based on the ratings. And in fact, I remember another discussion. I think I don't know whether it was the automobile industry. Somebody came in, and it may have been the ICI, but because of 9/11, when the markets went down and people were concerned about where the markets were, they were worried that because of the restrictions for investments that mutual funds could make, they were going to have to dump a lot of securities given and a lot of... debt instruments, given the fact that ratings were going to go to hell and so on and so forth, and they wanted us to lower the standards as to what passed muster. And we refused to do that because I just wasn't going to have any part of trying to do that. So we had discussions about it generally, but I must say I was actually surprised to have learned all that the SEC had maybe inadvertently but effectively done vis-a-vis ratings and locking in various things that both created monopolies and made people very dependent on getting these drinks and so on. And I was very troubled about that. We held one interactive hearing, I believe, because we had to do a report which was issued while I was there on the rating agencies and so on. But, you know, was it, in a sense, did we foresee what was going to happen with the rating agencies? No. And it wasn't a topic really of discussion, in part because the SEC before 2007 always looked at the ratings agencies in terms of equity securities. They really didn't look at ratings agencies in terms of derivatives. I mean, it just wasn't a focal point at the agency, which is unfortunate because I think it would have seen that. After I left, I have worked with a lot of hedge funds, and I do now work with a lot of hedge funds. But as prices were deteriorating and the markets were deteriorating, and FASB had come out with 157 and fair market value, which has been blamed, I might add, for a lot of the problems, and I just have to tell you, I don't give that one iota of credence. The problem with fair market value is not requiring people to account for assets of fair market value. The problem was that the government, the SEC, never helped assure a consistent way that people would value atypical assets for which there were no ordinary markets. So, and we got that question because I worked with a lot of hedge funds who said, well, what do we do? And I said, the only way I think you can really do this and comply is come up with a methodology. Yes, your accountants will have to bless it, but then hire an independent economist. And what I'd like is for the independent economist to review the way in which you have come up with values, what your methodology is, and have them certify that your methodology, all things being equal, should produce a rational result, not the right result, because there isn't any. If government had done that, if government had prescribed that, fair market value could not have been cited. And you know, there have been these. Now, under Dodd-Frank, by the way, the FSOC can overrule accounting treatment effectively. I and several former SEC chairs wrote a letter to the conferees saying, for God's sakes, don't approve that because you're not going to help people by now saying, okay, well, maybe financial institutions don't have to report fair market value. This is crazy. And economists have well-designed ways, and I've dealt with this in many cases, well-designed ways to figure out what the value of an asset is based on the assumption either that you'll hold it to maturity as leavened by your ability to hold it to maturity. I mean, this isn't rocket science. I really think you could calculate it, and yet what we found was people were just making it up. Just constantly they were. I forget who said it. Maybe it was Buffett or somebody who said they're marking to myth. There's nothing wrong with marking to a formula, provided you go back, you review the assumptions of the formula, you make sure that they're not changing on you, and that you're constantly updating all of this. They never did that, and the rating agencies were completely snowed by all of this, okay? People would go in, they'd make their case, they'd give them this presentation, they would sign off, and instead of coming back every week and seeing how the markets were dealing with this stuff, they thought they were writing or assigning a rating for all time. And that produced unreliable ratings. You can't equate the ratings that are given to equity securities for which there are standardized markets and the ratings given to individualized derivative packages, many of which have their own curlicues and so on. So you have to have a different methodology, and that requires some independent review, which most hedge funds either never thought of or were unwilling to spend the money on. And so they carried things on their books, and others did as well. The banks that had all these instruments did. And they wound up taking this huge bath because it wasn't priced in a rational manner and updated repeatedly because of the very atypical nature of the instrument. So afterward, that was something I saw repeatedly with the rating agencies. And I even had meetings with the ratings agencies in which I told them long before the crash, long before things started, but this was after I left the SEC in 2003 and 2004, that I thought they had to sit down and start coming up with best-in-class standards because people were going to come after them. I was told that that was a terrific idea, but they were already doing that.
What made you go to the rating agencies?
Because I started dealing with a lot of different hedge funds and started to see how the ratings agencies were, in derivative securities playing a much more critical role. I mean, the only way you could sell these things was with the ratings. That's what people bought them on. And so it concerned me because there is, one of the three great curses is be careful what you wish for. And when you have that much power, you know that it's going to come back and bite you in a part of your anatomy you don't want to be bitten. So you've got to do something about it. So that's why I went to see them. I thought that we could help them with all of that. So it wasn't completely altruistic. But it didn't matter because they weren't interested.
Can I ask just a couple of questions related to this? Where on the continuum of cause and complications would you put the rating agencies if you were us?
I think the rating agencies are high up, much higher than many others, but here's the problem. Nobody was, forget for the moment that there was no authority, okay, and that they weren't regulated. Nobody was raising the issue. So, yeah, I think that they wound up over their heads. I suspect that they must have been sitting there thinking they had minted money because of all these synthetic derivatives and so on that required all these ratings and so on. Nobody was sort of saying what was going on, etc. And even without direct regulatory authority over the ratings agencies, the SEC had authority over the investment banks that put these packages together. They could look at what due diligence was. The boards of these investment banks could have been saying, wow, the amount of our profits that are being derived from this has increased so exponentially. Shouldn't we worry about that? And so you had a lot of people who should have been worrying. And the Fed, somebody had to have blown the whistle. But having said that, I think that the ratings agencies failed and failed badly and were one of the prime culprits. But I think this problem is bigger than that. And so, and as I say, it's tough when people try to identify just one class or something like that. My concern is you lose sight of all the other people who could have done something too.
Don't worry, I said continuum.
No, I know. And I'm not worried. You guys will do whatever you do. But I think they were very high up on the list.
Then my next follow-up was going to be, you're suggesting that no one knew about this, the ratings agency problem. You think no one knew about this. You said this.
No, I think, when I said no one knew about it, I meant, I didn't mean no one knew about it. No one was focused on it,
okay,
what their problems were, because, first of all, although I haven't looked into their files, I suspect, and you had one person who testified, I thought, in one of the public sessions about how he was basically coerced into doing it. So I think people knew about this, but it's like so many things. It's like this little dirty secret, you know. People keep it. I don't think, much to my regret, that people at the SEC were focused on this issue. The fact is, in light of hindsight, we should have been. I mean, I don't have the slightest question that, you know, it was hard. And also, you know, you know the old expression, it's the squeaky wheel that gets oil. Well, you know, when your regulatory jurisdiction is broad, you tend to focus on the parts that seem to be not functioning at the moment, and so on. But yeah, I think the problems were known. I wouldn't in any way, shape, or form accept anyone saying that they either weren't known or couldn't be known. I think they were, and they could have been and they should have been known. I think, you know, this gets back to my opening point. The regulatory system we had didn't function, but it could have functioned even in the face of that. So the lack of authority or what have you is never really an excuse. I mean, we had when we had Enron, WorldCom, and all these companies, I came up with this idea that I wanted CEOs to certify their financials. Eventually, Sarbanes-Oxley enacted that as part of the law. But even before it was enacted, and certainly before it took effect, I felt I had to stop all these shoes from dropping. Well, I created a theory because we had some authority. And, you know, the American Bar Association filed a comment letter at some point saying, well, it's a very clever theory. We understand why it's needed here. But we don't think this is something the SEC should be doing. So, but I wasn't going to let that go on. Sorry. Sorry. Excuse me one second. I'll have to call you back, okay? Okay, but I'm in a meeting now. Okay? In a little bit. I'll call you when I'm done. Sorry. That was my son. I always take my kids' calls, so.
Well,
No. He just it's a great thing. I only hear from my son when he needs money. And, of course, the good news is he always needs money, so I hear from him every day. So that's fabulous. But so I apologize for that. So we did this. We came up with a theory. Now, if somebody sued us, would it have worked? I don't know. And I don't believe the ends justify the means by any means. But we had authority, and we had to use it. And I've often been somebody who said to clients about certain things, if you're going to have to do that, if I think it is against public interest, let a court tell you you have to do it. There's nothing. That's part of what bothered me about the whole Merrill and AIG situation with all these bonuses, because I think what happened there was they must have asked the lawyers, are we legally obligated to pay these retention bonuses? And I think the lawyers probably said yes, which is, I'm sure, a correct answer. But I always felt that when you represent a corporation, you weren't just calling balls and strikes. And my advice would have been, you may be legally obligated to do that. Let a court make you do it. Then you haven't done it, and, you know, somebody else will deal with that situation. So I just think that people don't step up. So the agencies could have done things, in my view. I mean, the Fed did things. It found ways to open the window and so on and do other things that were very creative. I think when you're in an emergency or you're in a difficult situation, you find ways to act responsibly and make sure everybody knows what it is you're doing and how you justify it. And so even without the authority over the ratings agencies, I think government could and should have done more. There's no doubt in my mind that they could and should have done more.
In the securities area, the SEC clearly had authority over the sale of the securities that were part of the securitization.
Mm-hmm.
They, to a certain extent, abdicated that with things like shelf registration and Rule 144A. They didn't really abdicate, but they took away the speed bumps
to looking at what was going into the securities market.
You want to comment on that?
Yeah, let me say, there's a rational basis for that concern, but I don't really buy into it because, in large measure, the speed bumps weren't achieving their purpose anyway. And I do believe, and again, because your mandate, and I'm not the one to tell you your mandate, but because your mandate is very broad, one of the things that I've always believed is that if a company needs capital, it ought to be able to get to the capital markets instantly, assuming that there's good disclosure out there about the company anyway and already. So shelf registrations, 144A, I don't think they're contributors. I think they were appropriate, policies for their time. The problem, the place where I think you really can be critical is, and not that I'm trying to be critical of the SEC, is that the SEC really didn't keep up with the times. And even today, in many respects, and again, it's not a criticism because I think they're doing a great job now, but what you see is people sort of have a predetermined way of looking at issues, and they never break free of that. And that is one of the worst diseases that can afflict regulation. If markets are changing dynamically, you have to inculcate the dynamics of change. I don't think that happened. I'm doubtful it's still happening. It is yet happening, and I'm doubtful it happens at other agencies. I think there's this. People tend to become comfortable with their way of analyzing issues or approaching them, and that's dangerous. That's why risk management, that's why trying to be much more proactive and understand the dynamics of markets is so important. If you're sitting as chairman of the SEC and there's a trend going on, there's no problem, but something is happening. That doesn't mean you can ignore that trend. It means that what you have to do is say, okay, this is certainly interesting. Let's get two or three people to sort of get on top of this so we know what it is, whether we have jurisdiction or not. Because even if we have no jurisdiction, maybe we're going to want jurisdiction. The place where I was when 9/11 hit, the first thing I did after 9/11, 9/12, was I got myself up to New York City, and I went to Ground Zero. I had meetings of all the major brokerage firms and the exchanges, as I mentioned earlier, and so on. And we held a press conference every afternoon, all of us, all of the people, so that the press could ask questions. Now, I've done crisis management all my life, in a sense, and the one thing I felt was we had to be out front. There was a crisis. I mean, the first objective of crisis management is to realize that you've got a crisis. Well, 9/11 was easy. We knew we had a crisis. So when you've got a crisis, you have to let people know that you've recognized you're in a crisis, that it's a problem, that you're there, that you have ideas. Here are what your ideas are, and if they don't work out or they start to show some problems, you're going to make adjustments and open yourself up to transparently addressing the issues. In my view, that was completely lacking all over government when the financial crisis started to hit. And I don't think it started to hit in 2007. It started well before that. But you look at the SEC, for example, with Bear Stearns going down, okay? Now, part of the problem I had was, and there were articles on this, where was the SEC? What were they doing? Why weren't they front and center? I can't answer that. I think I know some of the reasons. So, in my view, there's a crisis. You are on the public's payroll. You have an obligation to be a part of the solution. If not, get out of there and let other people solve it, and so on. So, I thought, as we saw the crisis unfold, the one thing we lacked consistently across government was transparency. So, for example, if you look at the meltdown with after Bear Stearns of Lehman Brothers, okay. Put way off to the side whether any or all firms should have been bailed out, because it's almost irrelevant. It's not, but it's almost irrelevant. But if your position, and this was the government's position, if your position is we're not going to bail out everyone, that's okay if that's your position. I might disagree with it. Maybe not, but now tell me what the criteria are. And they wouldn't do that because they didn't know. And as a result, it wasn't just Bear Stearns and Lehman. It was Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and those two firms should not have been in the extreme precarious position they were placed in. I think government made it worse, because government, for whatever policy it had, wasn't willing to be transparent. And I'll tell you, in a crisis, particularly a financial crisis, you can't treat this like pornography and say, I know it when I see it. That is not going to work. You have to tell people, here are my standards. And you know what? If I see something to change that, I'm not necessarily going to be wed to it, but here's the way I'm going to make my decisions, for better or for worse. That never happened. And so you had a bad situation, and in my view, government made it worse.
Mm-hmm. Were people you represented going to government asking them for these standards? I mean, after Bear went down, were people... You represented a lot of hedge funds, you mentioned. Was the view on the street at that point in March 2008 that the government was going to step in as central banker for any large firm, or was there a view that there were rules we don't know about, so we should go ask what they are?
Bernanke has said he was very worried about that.
I'm sorry?
Bernanke has said he was very worried about the hedge fund sector.
Yeah. No, nobody... I wasn't asked to do anything about that, but...
Were your clients asking you?
what are the ground rules here if we run out of money?
I had a lot of people saying to me, what's, you know, what do you think is going on here and so on. And so, yeah, that. But here's my my concern, I guess. If you see a situation deteriorating and you bail out, and it's hard to talk about Bear Stearns as a bailout because, but the bailout part was the $20 billion guarantee that was given to J.P. Morgan. That was the bailout. So, and then if you read Sorkin's book, Too Big to Fail, well, my wife says she thinks it's too big to read, but if you read Sorkin's book, all of the people who were willing buyers, and Lehman had real value. I mean, they had good, solid assets. What happened with Lehman was almost criminal, in my view. But if you read Sorkin's book, basically, everyone assumed, okay, well, we'll step in, but the government will give us some form of a guarantee. It was because government had created the expectation of a guarantee that ensured that Lehman could not be rescued, because everybody expected that the government would provide some incentive, and if it didn't, the company would go bankrupt, and then people would be able to buy the assets anyway, which is exactly what happened. And I have no doubt that's what their restructuring lawyers and bankruptcy lawyers told them, is, you know, you don't need to buy it now. If you buy it now, you're doing the government a favor. Buy it in bankruptcy. Yeah, you may have to bid, but that's okay. And that's what they did. That blood is on the government's hand, in my view. And in response to your question, I think it was all over the street that prior to Lehman, everybody assumed that the government would backstop any of these acquisitions. People were panicked in the government. Everybody knew they were panicked. I don't think Sorkin's book, by the way, is not a literary criticism. I don't think it's a very good book. It's basically just a calendar. Here's what happened on each day. But if you read it, it's fascinating for what appears to be the mindsets of the principal players. And I look at Paulson, who I knew for 30 years and admired, and Bernanke, who I knew much less and admired. I think they panicked. I think they just were afraid that on their watch, the United States was going to have another Great Depression. And that caused them to do a bunch of things, plus they were also worried about the political situation, so on and so forth. And part of what bothers me about that, and it's part of what bothers me about Dodd-Frank, is the reason why I think the Fed is a great agency, or was, is because it's independent. I think Dodd-Frank, and I think it happened before Dodd-Frank, but I think Dodd-Frank has weakened the independence of the Fed, because the Treasury Department is now in control of the FSOC, the FSOC can push on various agencies to do things, and the Fed uniquely among government agencies really needs to be independent. I think the Fed should have two functions. One is monetary policy and the other is systemic risk. I don't think they should regulate banks or anything like that. I just think those are the two things that they need. And the fact that you now have given Treasury so much authority means that, and this I know is unpopular, and so and it's unpopular on both sides of the aisle. Because both sides aspire eventually to control the administration. So I just think that those two functions should be totally independent, and they're not. And that is the single biggest weakness in Dodd-Frank, is that it may well have compromised the Fed's independence. We needed an independent Fed.
And you're saying you think the country's going to regret that?
Yeah. I think we'll all regret it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a quick question to follow
you
up?
You can ask me anything you want.
I know we've kept you here so long, but I
want to. No,
I just
that's fine.
Don't want to leave. I'm so curious. You were talking during the period of regulatory agencies and how they can have imagination and how they can be nimble. Can you talk a little bit about the chilling effect, the climate, the challenge of dealing with a deregulatory atmosphere or members of Congress and the political dynamics when you're actually in a regulatory agency trying to do the things you're talking about?
First, you have to understand I am about as close to being apolitical as is possible, even though when I served, people were looking for ways to politicize what our agency was doing. I have certain beliefs and principles, but I'm not an ideologue and I'm not a politician. That was clear, I think, from my tenure. I really think that the concern of deregulation gets distorted through the prism of politics. I do believe that there may well have been too great a reliance on the assumption that free markets can solve all their problems. But I've never believed that. If I really had believed that, I would never have accepted the chairmanship of the SEC, because in that role you must regulate the markets. But I'll tell you how it, and this is again a vignette, but I'll tell you how it impacts. During my predecessor's tenure, Arthur Levitt's tenure, he wanted the options exchanges to have a common interface so that people could compare pricing and decide where they wanted to execute a trade, because they almost all trade the same options and they're all standardized. And so he tried to do this by adopting a rule called the trade-through rule, which was a rule that basically said if you trade through the best national price, you violate the law. And he got the commission to pass that rule for options exchanges, but he never put it into effect. What he did was he tried to use the threat of that rule as a club to get the options exchanges together. That is an example of both overregulation and unnecessary regulation, but mostly ineffective regulation. Now, when I came in, I was very concerned about the same issue. What I did was I got the heads of all five, at that time, options exchanges in a room. And I said, here's my problem. If I'm a broker and a customer asks me to execute an option in IBM Securities, how can I tell where the best price is? Okay, I can't. So what we need is a common interface. And I said, I'm going to tell you the truth. I could care less what the interface looks like. I don't even really care if it's done this month or next month, provided that all five of you get together and agree, because there can't be any disagreement here. And if you don't do it, then I'll have to write a rule. And if I were in your shoes, I wouldn't want me writing that kind of a rule. Before I left in February of 2003, we had, and I repealed the trade-through rule, which was never put into effect because I thought it was illegal. If you adopt the rule but then never put it into effect, I believe that that's improper government behavior. When I left in February of 2003, we had a uniform interface with all of the options exchanges, and it went up and running. And unlike what you can do in the regular equity markets, etc., in the options markets, this is clearly standardized. So to my view, what I did was deregulation. And when I started as chairman, there was a big problem with analyst recommendations. And I thought this was a serious problem on the part of the industry. So I rented some space in New York City because the SEC couldn't take space from anybody. I rented space at my personal expense. And I convened the heads of then the NASD and the New York Stock Exchange and the heads of every major firm. I called them all myself. And I said, don't send me a lackey. I want each of you guys. And I laid out to them a list of six things I wanted them to do about analyst reports. And I said, if you guys do all this, I'll give you full credit. The SEC doesn't need the credit. Just do it. But if you don't do it, then we'll do it. And you have to have the same rule, which had never been true before for NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. Well, they did get it done in May. Unfortunately, it took them a little longer. I think our meeting was in November, and they got it done by May. And we had a big announcement. Again, somebody could argue that was deregulation, because I didn't need a government regulation to get what I wanted. But it really wasn't that kind of deregulation. It was simply a sense of saying there are some things I think we can do better, and most things I think those in the industry can do better, as long as I've got people looking over their shoulders. And I had staff people attend every meeting. They couldn't meet without us and so on. So I am sure that there are some people who believed in deregulation as if it were a religious principle. I didn't. I did believe that a new regulation was not always the answer to every problem. And I also suppose I had a slight bias that there might be better ways in the first instance, but that we always had to use regulation because that's what we were there for. We had to protect the public. So I give you that long wind-up because when I was there, nobody ever said to me before I was appointed, while I was in office, you have an obligation not to adopt rules of this or that. Yes, I knew that people weren't wild about more regulations, and OMB required you to justify it. But I never worried about that, because I knew if I thought we needed a regulation, we'd do it. And in January and February of 2003, I think we adopted 12 to 15 rules implementing Sarbanes-Oxley. So I knew I was going to have to do a lot of rulemaking. I never felt the least bit inhibited. I always felt if there was another way to get there, I might wind up better. In particular, and this is really important, because people misconstrue the difference between oversight and regulation. The fact that I don't need to define a rule or regulate doesn't mean that I don't need to oversee what's going on. So all I ever took, and I never felt bound by it, but all I ever took from people's deregulatory pushes were, is there a way to get where you want to go that is better than simply having government write a rule? And if I could answer that question, yes, I tried that first. And if I couldn't, then we did a rule.
The cooperation that you got, did it evaporate after you were gone? In other words, it was superseded by something else, or evaporated
in that
way?
Yeah. I'll tell you. I used to, and I've said this publicly, when I used to come into my office every day, I used to look at the bottom of my shoes to see what I had stepped in. When 9/11 hit, I was a hero because I applied my crisis management techniques. The country all came together. Nobody was fighting. Everybody cooperated. When Enron hit, I started to get pelted, because when I had been a lawyer, I represented all the major accounting firms. I represented every major player everywhere. I mean, I was a victim of my own success, if you will. I had a great legal practice. But the reason I wanted to go back as chairman of the SEC is because I love the agency, I believe in its mission, and I'd already achieved what I wanted to do with clients, so I wasn't looking for new clients or anything like that. But it didn't matter. And so instead of what I got from 9/11, Enron produced just constant bashing. I mean, just left and right and left and right bashing, because people needed a scapegoat and they wanted to take advantage of it, and so on and so forth. When I got in, I had observed my predecessor Arthur Levitt's tenure. He'd been there for 8 years, and nobody was coming into the agency asking, could they do things, would it be a problem if they tried this. Nobody would come in and discuss stuff with us. And I always have felt that government is a service business. And so I told people, if you come in and you ask us questions in good faith, we won't play gotcha, but, you know, come in and tell us what's going on. Because I think you can't regulate if you don't know what people are thinking about. After I left, I think that my successor was determined to distance himself from me, which is understandable. I distanced myself from my predecessor. And Bill Donaldson's successor, Chris Cox, distanced himself from Bill Donaldson. Mary is now distancing herself. So, I mean, that's unfortunately part of it. But I think it's not that there was less cooperation. It's that there was a less hospitable environment to exploring cooperation. And I'm not talking about giving anything away. I mean, my former clients all hated me on a lot of things I was doing. The investment company institute, which I had represented for over 20 years, was furious because I required mutual funds to disclose their policies on voting proxies and then report how they did it. And they thought this was a terrible thing that I had done. And so, but I believed in it and so on. But I think it was because there was no dialogue. I wanted people to believe, you can raise anything you want with us. I'm not going to do things just because you want them, but I'll listen, and then we'll do what we want. I think that's the way government functions best. I think it ceased functioning that way. And as a result, there's less cooperation because there's more mistrust. And that, in a way, is actually a piece of prudential regulation. I really don't like prescriptive rules that say that, particularly in the accounting area, where you get 800 paragraphs on dealing with a subject, and then what you do is you turn the accountants or the lawyers loose, and they can justify almost any result. What I really like is, here's why we're adopting this rule. Here's what we want. And here's how you should interpret this rule. And if you have questions before you act, feel free to ask. But if you act and you violate what we're concerned about, we'll clobber you. That is the way I think government should operate. And that's what I tried to do.
Nothing more? This has been one of the most informing enjoyable
guys.
2 hours and 15 minutes that that I've experienced at the commission. Thank you very much.
If you guys have more questions or whatever, or just want to try to understand something I was saying, that's fine. You're doing a very important thing. I'm, as I said at the outset, I'm worried that you've been marginalized a little bit. But I still think we don't really focus on what was wrong with our system. And what worries me the most is we have really not done anything to prevent or ameliorate the next crisis, because it's not going to look like the last one. And the only hope we have is in your report and your product. If you guys do it, we have a shot.
If I can go fishing for one thing, I know you have many clients.
I'm sorry?
I know you have many clients and you serve a sort of private sector risk management function. Are there any lessons learned that you've drafted for your clients in their respective fields, or lessons learned from the crisis of how to approach certain things, market liquidity, panic in the markets, VAR models, any of those things that might benefit us that you happen to have and wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I do a fair amount of speaking, much to the world's regret. And
I thought it spoke well at Steve's going away party.
As a result, I always like to end with my top 10 lessons learned, except, of course, I never have 10. I always have more than 10. So almost every talk I give to anyone has what I sort of like to think of as takeaways. I like people to do that.
I guess I'm asking for beyond that. Have you taken any deep dives internally, again, into, I doubt when you go out and give your speeches you get into the mistakes made in the VAR models. But have you guys taken any deep dives for your clients that might help us?
I have.
Think about it and you're willing to share that which you might think was helpful, I think that would help us. Embracing the spirit you had at the commission of going to the private sector and asking them to share knowledge.
Did you do work for Laban?
Yeah, It's probably not precisely what you wanted or want, but I'll tell you, I did do it. I did it, in a sense, both for Lehman and Goldman Sachs. But what troubled me, and I apologize for extending this, but Goldman Sachs was told by its lawyers that it didn't violate the law. Okay, I think if they did what the SEC's complaint says they did, it was probably a plain vanilla fraud. But to me, that's irrelevant. What is relevant is that nobody ever got what they wanted from the federal government by telling them how stupid and venal they are, which is what Goldman did. And so I've delivered two speeches on how Goldman shot itself in both legs and really was stupid just because it thought it could win. The truth of the matter was they were never going to be able to test whether they were right or not. And if they had litigated and lost, they would be out of business because you can't have a registered investment advisor, a broker-dealer, convicted of fraud. So they knew they couldn't litigate, even if they were right. So the point then becomes, well, how do you deal with these issues and so on? But I've done one for hedge funds, which I was talking about how to value tough assets and some of the lessons learned from the subprime crisis. That may be as close as what you want. So I'm happy to give you what I've got.
How many of the major players involved in the crisis were your clients?
I wasn't the only player of any major proportion. There were others, but was Paulson and Company, and they were on the right side of the gamble, so to speak. So,
so Lehman wasn't a client.
No,
okay.
No.
And Goldman wasn't, or isn't.
Oh no, no.
Okay. I just thought after you gave that speech, they might have hired.
No, if I hadn't given that speech, yeah.
I don't know.
They might have. But the interesting.
Is that speech publicly available, or can we get a copy of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would appreciate
it. It is. And you know, listen, I used to represent Goldman when I was at Freed Frank, and so I had great respect for them. I believe they were idiots. They totally mishandled, and I said so, just
right.
Almost in those terms, that you couldn't possibly want to handle a matter that badly unless you want to put yourself out of business and so on. That's why I, in connection with Lehman, I will say that a firm came to me seeking my guidance and to determine whether to retain us. And the type of advice you saw in the Goldman speech, or that I gave in the Goldman speech, was what I told this firm privately, and not surprisingly, they didn't hire us because they didn't like that advice. So, you know, that's okay. But I'll get you a copy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Before we go,
yeah.
My colleague Tom Krebs said I should pass along his regards.
Oh, well, thank you. Please please give him mine.
His son is being married this week.
Oh,
otherwise he would have been here.
Yeah, that's fabulous.